have taken your first step into a larger world. Let's go.
Hello there. I'm Rowan Williams.
I'm Baz McAllister.
And welcome to Force Material, the show that's all about the secrets and source material of Star Wars. Today, we are privileged to be talking about the magic of The Mandalorian with one of the people responsible for making that magic happen, Charmaine Chan. Charmaine is the virtual production technical director on The Mandalorian. If you don't know what that means, don't worry. We'll find out in a sec. She's also worked on a string of massive feature films, TV shows, theme park rides, and VR experiences in her time at Industrial Light and Magic so far, including The Last Jedi, Star Tours, Black Panther, the Jurassic World ride, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, and more. From making Porgs come to life to digitally erasing Tom Cruise's Apple box, she's done it all. She's also the creator of Women in Visual Effects, a video series that gives voice to women working in the industry and seeks to inspire future generations of women to enter the field. Charmaine, welcome to the show.
Hey guys, thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being here. So were you always interested in how movies were made? Like, what's kind of the movie that inspired you to get into visual effects?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a lover of films and movies from a super young age. And I think the one that really struck me the most was Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
I definitely remember seeing it for the first time as a kid. And I was all like, oh my God, dinosaurs are real. And, you know, it just blew my mind how just immersed you can get into that world just because that world was just so well created and those creatures were just, they seem practically real to me. So
yeah.
That's when I was just like, how does this get made? How does this get done? Because I definitely want to make dinosaurs for a living, you know? So that's what basically kickstarted it for me. But of course, you know, as I got older, you know, I got introduced to things like Indiana Jones and Star Wars. And that's when I was just like, wow, you can really expand and create worlds that don't exist through this visual storytelling, essentially.
So it's one thing to watch a movie like that, and quite another then to work out how to go about, you know, getting on the path that will take you to where you are today. So how did that all happen for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I didn't realize that path was possible originally. It was very much like, oh, I really enjoy doing art, but I also really enjoy technology. And I was very much that like introverted nerd kid, always on the computer. I will gladly say I'm a huge Spice Girls fan, and that kind of like kickstarted things for me, because I made a Spice Girls website, and that's like when I tackled on just like learning a little bit of HTML and like JavaScript and like, you know, being able to manipulate imagery. And I was all like, oh, this is fun. And so that kind of was like my introduction into basically the digital art medium. And that's what I thought I was going to get into more, which was like website development and design. But it wasn't until I went to University of California, Irvine down in Los Angeles. And I was kind of introduced into the world of LA and had friends who worked in the industry that were like, oh, why don't you actually consider coming into Hollywood? Your skills would totally transfer over. And that's basically where it kind of started. And I was all like, oh, I can do this on like a more video film, like that kind of level, as opposed to just like for the web. So that's when I started to look more into just like getting into both visual effects, motion graphics, just when it comes to general image manipulation. And it was quite an interesting route, because it was definitely more graphics oriented, like 2D graphics oriented originally. Then I started to educate myself and learn more about what there is to, you know, there is to visual effects. And then it was about a year after uni that I got a job at ILM.
Wow.
Really quick follow-up question. Who's your favorite Spice Girl?
Who's my favorite Spice Girl? Sporty Spice, hands down.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody's favorite.
So early on in your career at ILM, I mean, you were thrown right into it. You were supervised by Todd Vaziri and John Knoll on Ghost Protocol. I mean, was that a baptism by fire?
Oh, I mean, that was the thing. Was at ILM, I've gone through many different roles. I actually started more on a technical position. Mm-hmm. I was what they call a technical assistant, which, you know, you're someone who deals more with the back end of things when it's like file management, resource management, things like that. And that's when I started to learn more about the pipeline. Previous to ILM, I was working at Deluxe doing motion graphics. And so I kind of had like more of a 2D background, but I didn't know what specifically I wanted to get into. And so being able to start in a more technical role and learning more about the pipeline of how visual effects works kind of gave me an overview of all the different disciplines within visual effects. Mm-hmm. And so I got to see what like roto artists did, what layout artists did, animators, modelers, et cetera, et cetera. And to me, I was just very much like, I think compositing is the thing I want to get into. And so when I was an assistant technical director, which is someone who deals more with being the middle person between technology and the artist and creating processes and tools that help the artists, that's when I started to kind of pick the brains of compositors more and just be like, oh, what do you guys do on a daily basis as a compositor? Mm-hmm. And so my first ever compositing show was Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which was supervised by John Knoll, and my comp supervisor was Todd Vaziri. And it was such an eye-opening experience to go from like a very like technical, how do I make your tools, to like, oh, visually, what are we trying to do? Mm. But at the same time, it was, you know, very much, I feel like my whole career at ILM, and still is very much a learning process, a very educational process, because technology is ever changing, and those are our tools that we use to create our visuals. And so it was, you know, it was very nerve-wracking, definitely, for sure, when you're on your first show. But when John Knoll finals your first ever shot, there's quite a gratification from that, knowing that, oh, okay, if John thinks this is good, then I'm on the right path.
And it was on Ghost Protocol, I've read this story somewhere, that you had to digitally remove an Apple box that Tom Cruise was standing on. I mean, that must have been a strange experience.
Yeah, I mean, the fun thing about visual effects is there's so many different things that you touch upon, right?
Yeah.
There's whole new worlds that you're creating, but there's also the little things where it's all like, oh, right, the person forgot to brush their hair, we got to paint out that one little stray hair. You know, like, there's both the very visible visual effects, and then there's the invisible visual effects, right? So when it comes to things like removing Apple boxes or painting things out, you know, it's always a fun process, because you're trying to make people believe that what they see is exactly how it is. So it's a good trickery skill to have.
Yeah. On, I guess, you know, heading into your Star Wars work, so on The Last Jedi, you spent a lot of time working on Kylo Ren and Luke Skywalker's final duel. When, you know, Baz and I and the rest of the audience saw that scene, you know, it's a beautiful scene, it's a shocking scene, it's one of the all-time great Star Wars scenes. When you saw the film, could you appreciate that scene, or were you just sick to death of looking at it by that point?
Yeah, I mean, it's always tough, because when you have sequences like that you've worked on for like almost half a year, and it's like literally what, 2 minutes on the screen.
Yeah.
it can be hard to separate yourself from the work that you did. But at the same time, when you do see it all tied in together, you're just like, oh, this is why we spent so much time working on it. And it makes it really worth it at the end, because just, you know, it's so visually dramatic and visually, it makes you like hold your breath to a certain point, right? Because you're just like, oh, what is going on right now? And that's what we're trying to pull across, right? And sometimes you can't get that from just doing one or two iterations of a style, of a look. You need to do multiple variations. You need to see what really fits in that cut, and sometimes that takes a while, but I think that's all part of the process. Like, it's very much, you know, were trying to make it as impactful as possible. And that takes time.
So I was going to say, I love the attention to detail in that scene. For example, it took me until my second watch to realize that, you know, Luke wasn't making footprints. Kylo was just, but you can't telegraph that too much when you do what you do. So, you know, you have to kind of maintain that balance of keeping it a surprise, but also that meticulous attention to detail.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very much all about the subtle visual clues that we can give. It's, you know, it was very important for us to make sure that it was able to be shown that the salts were, you know, the salt flats were being covered by salt slowly over time. Mm-hmm. And you notice that it's covering Kylo's footprints, but it's not covering Luke's.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just those little things that it makes me really appreciate the collaborative environment that we have and the people being able to call out those things and say like, hey, we need to make sure this is consistent and that we're sticking with this storyline throughout. So it's a great, yeah, like I said, it's a great collaborative environment at ILM where we make sure that whether or not we're introducing these little details or it happens to be a happy surprise, you know, like those are things that we want to watch out for when we're working on these shots.
Yeah. And you've said that Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai was an inspiration for your work on that scene. Can you sort of expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I think Rian Johnson was very much a fan of Kurosawa and constantly referred back to certain scenes that, you know, he felt very much inspired by. I don't think there was a sense of like, oh, he was trying to copy exactly what Kurosawa was doing. I think he was just very moved by the feelings you get by certain shots, such as in Seven Samurai, mm-hmm. That, you know, would completely work in Last Jedi as well. So I think as, you know, as a director, as someone who's trying to help visual effects artists get the story he wants to get across, he was very adamant about, you know, making sure that we were also influenced by these directors and artists. Because, yeah, I think at the end of the day, you know, we draw inspiration from so many different places, and being able to draw inspiration from classics like Seven Samurai is, you know, is very, to me, it's an honor to be able to do things like that and be able to execute it in a way where it actually did work. So, yeah, I think it's very filmmaking in general, and being able to acknowledge how filmmaking has been made in the past and present is very much a constant thought that a lot of the visual effects artists tend to have. And, you know, how do we take it to the next level, which is always a fun thought.
What's your favorite shot that you worked on in The Last Jedi?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I mean, I think one of those close-up shots of Kylo holding his saber during that duel, where it just like, it's like a really slow pull out on his face, and you see the saber reflections in his eye, and it's just like intensity of like emotions. I think that was one of my favorites, just because I don't think I've really had shots before that really emotionally set a tone like that, like the anger and frustration that Kylo has been going through, which is funny because I felt like I went through anger and frustration working on those shots too. So I felt very empathetic to Kylo at that time as well, which is quite funny. But yeah, it's, you know, it's definitely one of those, it's not a difficult shot, but it was one of those shots that, you know, leave you going, hey, like this shot really makes an impact and change specifically in this sequence. And, you know, there's a lot of times as visual effects artists, we're just given a lot of shots all at once and you kind of just have to like churn through them. But when you're really spending that time on those shots for a really long period, it does affect you differently than when you're quickly turning out shots.
Yeah. So you're currently working on The Mandalorian. And I think we all knew the show would be popular, but were you surprised that it would be this popular? Because everyone who's a fan seems to love it. And this, you know, divisive fandom that we're all a part of, it seems to have united everyone together in love of Baby Yoda.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because, like, when we were shooting, you know, it was definitely like, all right, this is going to be a fun series. There's definitely, like, you know, you get a sense of quest of the week kind of set up with the show, which is like a very different format to a lot of the other content that we've created. But at the same time, we had no idea how this was going to do, you know, and especially with Baby Yoda, we're just all like, I mean, to me personally, the first time I saw Baby Yoda, I was all like, this is the cutest thing ever. I want to pick it up and hug it immediately, which I didn't because the puppets were very precious characters on the set. But yeah, it's one of those things where, similarly to when we first introduced the Porgs, you know, it's like, well, we think they're fun characters and they're cute. How the rest of the world is going to embrace it, we don't know. Is it going to be like a Jar Jar scenario, or is it going to be a whole new scenario? Like, it's always up in the air when it comes to how the audience is going to receive these new characters. But happily, everyone loved Baby Yoda, which is very much... you know, what we were hoping for, but I don't think we were ever expecting it to blow up the way that it did. I think the fact that, like, you know, the first moment people saw Baby Yoda and just the internet's went crazy with memes everywhere, yeah. Right? Like,
yeah,
that's when you're like, oh, right. I think it's doing well. It's going to do fine.
So you are the virtual production TD, the virtual production technical director on The Mandalorian. For the layman and me and Baz, what does this mean? Can you sort of take us through, like, what your role is in making the show?
Absolutely. So for The Mandalorian, that was one of our first times really pushing the limits on what we can do with real-time rendered environments used on location, on set, and in real time. Mm-hmm. And so as a virtual production TD, I'm basically one of the five artists who are there in what we call the brain bar. And we basically handled making sure the environments we were putting up on the screen interact and cohesively blend with the practical set and actors that were on stage during that time. Mm-hmm. You know, that included things such as, like, you know, moving objects and geometry in the 3D scene around, or color correcting or lighting. So we each kind of had different tasks that we were put on, but it's basically, think of it as your usual visual effects artists in a post-production world, but put them in the production world. Mm-hmm. So they're there to edit things live, essentially. Wow. And whatever you see in the camera is literally what you get, which is, you know, to me originally, I thought, oh, there's no way we can do that. Then as we, you know, did the episodes, I was like, oh no, we can do this. Like, I'm surprised how well it actually works. Like, you look through your camera and you're like, we're pretty much done with this shot. We don't need to do any additional visual effects, which is a crazy thought process, because for us, we're so used to being at the end process and being the final edits, to actually being on the set and seeing what that looks like immediately is a complete game changer.
Yeah. So let's talk about how stagecraft. So when I say stagecraft, I guess people listening to the show probably would know it as the volume. So if you've seen, like, the you know, the Disney Gallery, the Mandalorian show, where they talk about, you know, the behind the scenes making of the Mandalorian, they talk a lot about the volume. But so its technical name is stagecraft, right? Or
right. So stagecraft is ILM's virtual production suite. So real-time rendering and the volume is one section of stagecraft. But
right.
We also do other parts, such as, like, when it comes to doing pre-vis, post-vis things, to using VR headsets for scouting to, you know, a huge vast array of basically tools that allow directors, showrunners, and DPs to virtually be able to see their environments and create their worlds without needing to wait until post-production for that process. So again, it moves post-production into the production world and gives gives people the tools to basically make their films like traditional filmmaking. And it's not so much something that we have to plan for as an afterthought and more something that we do exactly as we shoot.
Yeah. So in terms of like your workflow, so you guys are working on effects for shots before the shot is filmed so that the background can be displayed on the LED. Like how does that all, how does it sort of affect that and, you know, and change your workflow?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it changes the workflow hugely. It just shifts it to be earlier as opposed to later. And so like you're saying, we did location scouting and we went out to different parts of the world to shoot references and photogrammetry for a lot of the environments that we created in Mandalorian. And what would happen is we would then take that footage and reference and bring it back to our offices. And per usual, we have our amazing environment artists, 3D artists, who then pack it together into a 3D scene that we can then use day of when we're shooting. So again, it's not very different than our usual post-production setup, in which case same thing would happen. It's just that generally it would happen in like your shoot locations and reference and photogrammetry would happen maybe in parallel as things are shooting, so you wouldn't be able to see exactly what they're shooting with actors, and then we just have to create an environment and make it fit with whatever they shot. In this case, we're able to create a base environment and be able to edit and adjust it per the director and DP's needs right there on site. So there's a lot less work that we would have to do later down the line. Like I said, the whole point is to try and get more in-camera finals as opposed to needing to ship it off to post to get it fixed later.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because, like, and even, you know, I think when a lot of us sort of talk about, you know, that this technology, like we've there's been a lot of talk about the benefits for the actors of being able to sort of fully immerse themselves in a scene, you know, that gone are the days of like having a green screen behind them and just sort of having to imagine that, you know, a mop or something is actually, you know, an alien, you know, so, but also like obviously for you guys, it's massive in terms of, you know, as you say, like just you're getting as much in camera as possible and getting, you know, for example, like, you know, even just stuff like the, as they show in the behind the scenes features, like the reflections on Mando's armor are, you know, accurate because they're coming from an, a, you know, an actual, well, not an actual, but, you know, a simulated environment behind it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, as a compositor, I'm generally the one who has to deal with the green screen or the blue screen and extracting people off of plates and putting them into new environments. But now being able to, number one, not need to use green screens, or number two, have a limited, smaller green screen makes a huge difference, right? Because I think a lot of things that people don't realize when it comes to green screen and blue screen is that, you know, you're extracting an object off of a background, like whether that be a blue or a green screen, and that requires you taking out certain colors. And when you do that, I always feel like skin tones just don't look as natural as they would in natural lighting. And I mean, if you, even if you look at plain green screen footage, right, you see all this green spill on the actors. And it's just not aesthetically pleasing. And to me, that's what always causes green screen footage to look like it was basically comped, where it was cut out. And I think having this environment where your environment exists and that environment is lighting the actors, like you said, makes it so much more realistic, but also it just preserves that natural skin tone that we want and gives us, you know, that those richer colors and hues that, you know, sets up a shot to look good. So you're starting from a place of success already and then building upon that, as opposed to needing to subtract and take away and then add back in. So that's the way I see it, as both a compositor and as a virtual production TD, as, you know, this is such a better toolkit to be able to start from a much natural beginning of a shot, as opposed to trying to completely fake something that doesn't exist.
Yeah. So does it increase the level of collaboration that's required between, you know, different departments and vendors to be able to sort of create those images in real time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was super lucky to be able to work directly with the DP and the gaffers. And, you know, it's interesting because with visual effects, you're usually just working with visual effects artists. Being able to step on a set and be a visual effects artist and work with the lighting guys, to work with the props people, to work with, you know, the set creators, it's so much more collaborative. And you're all just trying to make the best, you know, image you can see on the screen. And the communication was super important during Mandalorian. You know, there are times where, you know, we create these beautiful vast desert scenes, and then let's say the set guys put in, you know, a building here, and we light up the stage with those screens, and you're just all like, oh wow, the lighting from the screens have completely changed what we thought the building would look. And then it's a case of like, oh, do we repaint the set, or do we quickly just change the lighting in the 3D scene? And most of the times the quicker answer was, yes, we're going to change the lighting in the 3D scene. And having that flexibility makes a huge difference, and it's such a time saver, right? So like, when you think of it in old school filmmaking terms, you know, if the lighting doesn't work, do you change the lighting, or do you change the set, or do you change, you know, like, there's a lot of things that you have to worry about. And in this case, if we have that control via stagecraft, it makes a huge difference.
It must be fun for you to, well, I mean, quite nerve-wracking as well, I'm imagining, but it must be fun for you to actually be on the set while all this is happening, as opposed to, you know, working on it in post.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I've never really been on a set long enough to see what the full process is like. As a visual effects artist, occasionally I would go on set to shoot references, or, you know, go out on like B-roll footage kind of scenarios, going just to random locations where the actors aren't actually there. And so to be able to see how the acting process is like has given me such a newfound respect for actors. And beyond just actors, you know, talking about the people that we're working with when it comes to like set props, lighting, etc. And seeing what the whole process really is from beginning to end. I don't think most people get that chance, but if they ever do, they should, because there's so much to be learned about what that filmmaking process is like by being on set versus being part of that end process in post-production. So for me, it was an amazing experience. And, you know, I feel like I learned so much about how this the process of filmmaking, the process of being on set and seeing practical light, seeing practical sets, has so much correlation and parallels with our visual effects creation. That should really be the foundation for folks when they're interested in getting to visual effects. Because at the end of the day, it's still filmmaking. It's filmmaking with tools, and you're sitting at your desk on your own generally, but its fundamentals are still very much based on, you know, how Hollywood first started off with films. And, you know, I think that's something as artists we need to acknowledge and embrace more. Because I talk to a lot of kids today, and they're like, oh, should I learn how to use Maya? Should I learn how to use Nuke? And I'm like, the tools are always going to be changing. But what doesn't change is how you light a scene, how you composite a scene. You know, like, there are very much fundamentals and how cameras work that is so important to acknowledge when you're going into visual effects.
I'm old enough to remember playing the video game Unreal, and it's obviously the Unreal engine that's made the stagecraft possible in the first place. So I'm just wondering, firstly, are you a gamer? And secondly, can you see applications for video games in the way the stagecraft works? Because I'm not that much into the idea of VR goggles, but put me in the middle of that and put me in a game myself, and I'm suddenly, I'm interested.
Yeah, it just so happened that for season one, we collaborated with Epic, who makes the Unreal Engine, to do the real-time rendering. And personally for me, I am indeed a gamer. I've been playing video games for so long. Like, I start off with the original NES, and, it's funny because I think back to those times where my dad's like, oh, why are you playing video games all day? Video games aren't going to get you work. And now I'm literally using a video game engine to do my work. So it's crazy to think of that whole path and evolution of video games. And, I've always known that the video game industry and the visual effects industry are very similar, especially in our, processes, tools, and like we're all, again, trying to be visual storytellers. So to me, I think it's very exciting that, the industry is actually getting to the point where it acknowledges that, it doesn't matter whether we're doing films, VR, or video games, they're all mediums for the storytelling, right? And VR headsets, I'm similar to you. I get motion sickness quite easily from it, so I'm not the biggest fan of them. But I can see the huge use to having them, especially when it comes to, again, with the production process of filmmaking. You can do things where, like, you put on the headset, go onto the stage, and you can see your environment. Let's say the LED screens aren't installed yet. You can see that environment right away and know that, like, oh, as the director, I can tell my actors to stand here and here and block that all out before you are even ready to shoot. It's such a huge advantage to be able to do things like that. But also in addition to that, right, what are the other possibilities of VR headsets? There's a case in scenario where we have our motion captured actors who are going to be eventually made into digital creatures, aliens, dinosaurs. Actors don't get to see that, right? They're looking at someone who's kind of in a PJ outfit with little dots all over them. How do you act to that? If you give the actors the VR headset, then they can actually see that digital creature immediately, and they can actually act how they would act if they saw, let's say, a raptor right in front of them. So I think there's huge potentials in the future, whether it be VR headsets or real-time rendering. And we're just starting to see what those potentials are. So it's a very exciting time to be in virtual production. To push the limits on, what we can do with filmmaking to make that filmmaking process easier for everyone, but also more engaging for everyone as well.
The potential of this technology, stagecraft, real-time rendering, et cetera, I mean, it feels revolutionary. Like, there was filmmaking before this, and there's filmmaking, there's what you can do after this. I mean, is that what it feels like to you, or is it essentially just another tool at the end of the day?
I would say it's actually a little of both, right? Like, we have to acknowledge that we will always need to use new technology and new tools to do our work. To bring our work to that next level. But at the same time, there is something different about real-time rendering, about the abilities that we have with stagecraft. It really, again, like I said before, puts us right in parallel with the directors and the DPs to just be able to create that world that they envisioned right there from the start. And it makes a huge difference, again, not just on director and actors level. It makes a huge difference for everyone that's on set. And, you know, it's making people rethink how exactly they should be filming things, which I think for a while has kind of been on auto mode, right? They're like, right, if we're doing a superhero movie, then clearly people are going to be flying around and we need these worlds. So automatic, we're just going to shoot everything on green screen.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people have been so used to that. And, you know, even directors have been so used to like, all right, that's fine. That didn't work when we shot it. We'll just fix it in post, right? That's the most common phrase that you hear. Yeah. We'll fix it in post. Which, you know, to me is kind of lazy filmmaking. You know, like you should be making sure that you are getting as accurate and as, you know, authentic of a portrayal in camera. And this makes it feel like we can do that. We can do that right from the start. And we don't have to think about fixing it in post. Mm. It's all about let us shoot what we see and that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in the same way as Seven Samurai influenced your work on that scene in The Last Jedi, were there any other films that you can think of that influenced what you did on The Mandalorian?
I mean, personally, for me, I'm constantly drawing inspiration from numerous films. I mean, like, there was definitely one moment when we were doing the cantina scene in Mandalorian, and our director of photography, Baz, he literally had on his laptop the original cantina scene.
Wow.
And he was all like, make that look like that. And I was like, oh, okay. And, you know, it's like, it's that moment where you're all like, I need to make Star Wars look like Star Wars. You're just like, right. There's a lot to hold up to that, you know, and like just thinking back to, you know, how George handled scenes and thinking back to like, you know, just the overall feel of the original trilogy. And so, yeah, it's funny. I was drawing inspiration from Star Wars originally. And it's one of those things where it's all like, yeah, we can do this. We can definitely recreate that feeling of walking into the cantina, the lighting, the atmosphere. And it was that kind of weird point where it was just scarily just so exact that everyone who was working on the stage that day would just like see it and be all like, we are literally in the cantina right now.
Yeah.
And you just can't beat that feeling, right? Like,
yeah.
We know that this isn't real, but at the same time, it so enveloped that feeling of the original episode that you were just like, wow, this makes a difference.
We were talking to, I think it was Phil Shostak, the Lucasfilm creative arts manager, and I think he said that he had to go and retrieve the original blueprints for the cantina set from episode 4. For that scene. And that gives you a sense of just how many people are involved in, you know, at every level of getting these details right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, our art department was amazing. You know, we would go through this process where they would mock up a real-time scene very quickly and just be all like, can we see how this looks up on the screens? And so we'll load up their environments and put it up, and they're like, you know, they're like, oh yeah, that shouldn't be there. Let's make sure this is there. And it's like right then and there, they're able to really create the new worlds, but also be all like, all right, in episode 4, was that really there? And, you know, stay true to the content that we originally created. And, you know, Pablo would be there on set as well. And he would, you know, advise when needed. And so we were very much aware of making sure that, you know, we stay true to the Star Wars universe, but at the same time, give people the excitement of whole new worlds and whole new characters that they've never been introduced to before. So like I said before, there's always a nod back to original filmmaking when it comes to our visual effects and real-time rendering processes. We are not trying to reinvent the wheel in any way. We're just taking what we know and enhancing it even further.
Yeah, well, that's one of the things. I mean, one of the themes of Star Wars, kind of going back to that, you know, the original film, has always been this idea of, you know, man versus machine, technological versus organic, you know, the underdog versus the big guy, Working, you know, working for ILM, you know, having the most advanced technology the industry has ever seen at your disposal. I mean, yeah, how do you sort of retain the humanity of the stories that you're telling?
Oh, that's a tough question. You know, at the end of the day, like you said, we're just trying to, we are trying to help the process of the storytelling. We are there to guide through visual imagery. And so, you know, most of the times you have a lot of artists who are very passionate about, you know, certain stories and certain characters, and they're invested into this world as well. And I think that's what shines across when you look at the breathwork of visual effects that ILM has done, is that the artists are very much, you know, engaged with the storytelling process. We want to make sure that, you know, what you see is exactly the feeling that the director, that the writer, you know, was trying to present with it. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a tough question, right? Because, like, I don't think there's one answer to resolve that. I think it's very much a case-by-case scenario, and a lot of it comes from, you know, your leadership, your supervisors, your, you know, creative directors. You know, they're all there to help guide what that visual image will be so that we get the best story out there.
Yeah, absolutely. As well as, you know, your work on The Mandalorian and all these ILM projects, you know, you've also got this project of your own, Women in Visual Effects. What was the impetus for starting that project? And yeah, what's sort of, so these are sort of interviews that you do with women who are working in the field?
Yeah. So funny enough, I decided to embark on the Women in Visual Effects video series basically at the start of 2016, which in America at that time, I'm not sure if you recall, there was a very important election happening between two very,
very, I don't think we were told about that.
No, I don't think we heard anything about that over here. You'll have to, don't know.
And yeah, you know, it was Trump versus Hillary. And as a woman, I personally was very much like, I can't wait for our first female president. And at the same time, I've always been in this situation where I felt like there are so many amazing, talented women within my industry. Yet at the same time, you don't know them. You never hear from them. They're not the ones that are being limelighted in the industry. And it's not like I've experienced, you know, anything horrible at my company or any discrimination at my company. But I think it was just a need for female voices to be heard, you know. And part of it was just, for me personally, entering the industry, I was completely embraced and I thought it was amazing and I learned so much from so many different people. But at the same time, I was like, oh, everyone that I see around me doesn't look like me. And I'm very much a believer in that representation matters. And to me, I'm like, if I, you know, it's hard when you can't see someone similar like you succeeding in the world to think that you will succeed as well. But the thing was, as I worked in the company longer, I realized that these people do exist, right? Women do exist, doing amazing jobs. People of color exist. LGBTQ people exist. And the thing is, they're there. Why are we not highlighting them? Why are we not giving them the platform to be able to talk about their craft? Because they all have amazing experiences throughout the year, these years. And luckily for me, working at ILM, you know, a company that's been around for 40 years, I'm working with people who worked on these original films that inspired me, you know, whether that be E.T. or Jurassic Park. And these included women. And so I think, you know, the little girl in me was like, if I knew that from a much younger age, you know, I think I would have jumped on it far sooner. I think I, you know, wouldn't need to go about a roundabout way to figure out that, like, oh, maybe visual effects is what I want to do. And so I created a Women Visual Effects series so that, you know, we have the accessibility to hear the stories from women. And it's been such an eye-opening experience for me interviewing all these women, because, you know, I started off in the San Francisco ILM office, but then I went out to London, I went out to Vancouver, I had other colleagues who went out to, you know, Sydney and Singapore, mm-hmm. and we tried to get as many stories as possible, and it's just so inspiring, even for me to this day, to hear the stories from other women. And I hope it'll do the same for, you know, any other woman out there who's interested in industry or who already is in this industry. You know, there's something to be said about feeling that you're not alone, that there are people who've gone through this similar path as you and who do make it. So yeah, that was my intentions with the series. And it's still very much a thing that I'm passionate about and want to make sure that, you know, every marginalized group out there is aware that, you know, visual effects is something you can get into, is something that you have an opportunity to get into, is something that can take your storytelling and visual imagery skills to the next level. So yeah, I love this industry so much. I want to make sure that people feel that passion and feel embraced and feel accepted within our industry as well.
With all those interviews that you've done, have you noticed any recurring themes coming up with the interviewees, or any commonalities between them besides the obvious?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think the one thing that interviewing women around the world has definitely highlighted is that there are a lot of root and common issues in our industry that we just need to really, you know, work on. And some of those include just like really long hours working overtime. A lot of women drop out of industry because how can they balance both family and work if you're at work 16 hours a day, right? And that's not just women, that's just general life and health of visual effects workers out there. Do we really need to be spending that many hours to get the work across there? I mean, I personally think the answer is no. I can get the work I need to be need out there done in the typical 8 hours. And I think, you know, that's something we need to emphasize more, because people are just not productive, you know, after 10, 12 hours of working straight, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, how do you get your best,
how do you get the best results if you're, you know, pushing people to, you know, their literal physical body limits, you know, and you can't. And the thing that I really appreciate at ILM is that, you know, we've been very, very focused on making sure that overtime is not happening unless it's absolutely necessary. And I think we need to embrace that more. And I hope other facilities and other visual effects artists are, you know, saying no when they should be saying no. 'Cause a lot of these artists are being worked just completely down to their bones. And, you know, as much as we all love watching movies and making movies, it's not worth it, right? And like I said, you don't get your best results when you do that. You get your best results when you collaboratively, you know, work with others and know your limits. We need everyone's brains, you know, at top notch. So you only get that when you get proper sleep. That's one of the topics that it's highlighted. Not to say that that's like how everyone works in the industry, but, you know, it makes it a very toxic environment that women don't want to be in. And, you know, no one should be in that kind of environment. So, you know, it's not just a woman issue. There are many issues within our industry that should be resolved. But at the same time, you know, I think we should be aware of them and we should actively try and change those in addition to continuously, you know, trying to make the best work we can out there.
How does that change? I mean, obviously it's unfair to expect any one person to have the answer, but, you know, from your perspective, like what do you think needs to happen?
I mean, I think it all really comes down to communication, which is a really silly thing to say. You would think most people would be able to express, you know, what they're feeling, what they're currently going through. But I think, you know, as with anything in Hollywood, that glamour and idea of working on a film surpasses your own personal needs.
Mm.
And I think people need to acknowledge that boundary and be vocal about, you know, knowing what their personal needs are. You know, if you've worked 7 days a week for a month straight, why? Like, is that actually really necessary?
Mm.
And yeah, I think people need to speak up more, because no one's ever going to change anything if they think everything is fine.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, just like my series, being able to hear women speak up about, you know, these issues of working overtime, these issues of, you know, not being heard, them actually saying it on a platform that's out there for everyone to hear, you know, makes it more possible for people to realize these problems exist and that we need to change these problems.
Mm. You've already worked on some amazing projects in your career. Obviously, we've been over some of them this episode. But what's kind of the dream job for you? Like, is there a particular director or franchise you'd love to work with that you haven't had the chance to work with yet?
Oh, that's a good question. So I think one of the biggest ever perks working within the Star Wars universe is that a lot of these directors, a lot of these actors somehow always end up within the Star Wars franchise. And, you know, like for me, I was a huge fan of Rian Johnson, you know, Brick was an amazing film. Looper was also such a great film. And to hear that he was going to be doing Episode 8 was just like, ah, oh, I can't wait to pick his brains to see what he wants to do with this. And so I think working under Rian Johnson was an amazing experience. I'm super excited for, you know, who else may be coming into the Star Wars franchise.
Mm-hmm.
With Mandalorian, that was my first glimpse into seeing how Deborah Chow works as a director. And I thought she was so amazing to watch, not only because she was an Asian woman director in Star Wars, but because she has such an interesting perspective on how to shoot. And I think that was the main fun thing about Mandalorian is, you know, we had so many different directors and seeing how they directed each episode was like, it was such a treat, you know, and they all had their own different styles. Mm. But at the same time, you watch the series all together and you're like, it works. It all meshes. Like, you can't even tell, you know, it was different directors because the story held so well. But at the same time, there are little things here and there that you're just all like, oh yeah, that's totally what Taika would do. Oh yeah, that's totally what Deborah would do. And so I'm super excited that Deborah Chow is going to be helming the next Obi-Wan series. You know, like, I would love to work with her again. So, you know, I feel very lucky to be in a spot where, you know, Star Wars franchise is able to bring in all these directors and talent, both, you know, veterans and new talent. And to me, that's the exciting part of filmmaking. Like, sure, there's, you know, the typical big name directors and big name writers out there. But like, to me, it's about like, what's something new we can bring to this franchise? Mm.
I was going to say, you also worked on Black Panther, which is one of the blockbusters that really focused on, you know, representation for people of color in particular and women of color, both on and off camera, I believe. So did that feel like a big step forward for representation within the industry?
Absolutely. I mean, here's the thing, right? You know, when I've worked in the industry for over a decade now. I've done quite a different variety of films. And after a while, you know, you feel like you're kind of just doing the same thing after a while. It's all like explosions after, you know, space here, superheroes there. Like, it feels a little monotonous after a while, don't get me wrong. And, you know, when Black Panther came out, there was something very different about it. And I think it starts from the top, right? So Ryan Coogler, Bay Area native from Oakland, very much, you know, aware of the need for representation. You know, he started off with Fruitvale, right, which is a small independent film, to getting this big Marvel Disney blockbuster that was Black Panther. And, you know, he never lost his roots or his sight of like what he's trying to do, which is bringing positive representation into media. And that happened, like you said, across all levels, both the actors that you saw on the screen to everyone working behind the project. And I think that trickled down even into ILM as well. I mean, I think Black Panther was the first time I ever worked with supervisors that were people of color.
Mm.
I'm not sure if that was a conscious decision or not, but it made a difference. Like, to me, to see that Ryan Coogler was very much like, I am making sure that marginalized groups are given the opportunities and chances, and seeing that trickle down to the visual effects level as well, you know, it's a huge thing. It's a huge step forward. And, you know, I was just so excited to work on Black Panther. And it's so rare for me to be that, you know, feel that proudness on a project.
For you personally, I mean, you're someone who's always been interested in storytelling, and you've now had that experience of being on set, seeing, you know, the Deborah Chows, the Taika Waititis, the all these guys work up close. You know, do you harbor any ambitions personally to direct, or have you sort of found your calling in visual effects?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I mean, I can say that, you know, I've thought about, like, what are the next steps? What are other possibilities when it comes to filmmaking? And I see how directors work, and I see what directors have to take on. And it's a lot, right? Mm. You know, I have so much respect for directors and what they're able to accomplish. But I think there's still a lot within the filmmaking storytelling process that I have to learn, right? Like, I feel like the writers, the people who create the core of these stories, are such a mystical mystical beings to me. Like, I wish my brain can create like what they can create. For me, I've always felt like I'm a good translator. Mm-hmm. I like being able to take what someone is trying to say and, again, enhance what they're trying to say. Create like, to me, I've always been a lot more visual than I am both a speaker or a writer in any sense. And to me, I feel like I express myself the best through imagery. And so I'm not saying visual effects is the end all be all game for me, but I definitely do have a preference of trying to tell stories through images. And I think that's where I shine best personally for me. But there, again, I feel like there's a lot more for me to learn and a lot more of that process. So yeah, to me, my whole career has been an educational experience. And yeah, I hope that doesn't change is a thing, because I don't think I'm at the end of my path yet. I don't think I'm, you know, at my extreme best potential. And I feel there's so much more to learn and grow. And I think, you know, that's a common trait you see with a lot of visual effects artists that you work with, is that they're so passionate about storytelling through visual imagery, and they're constantly trying to push themselves to see what that is. You know, it's a rush, it's a thrill. That's what I love about this industry.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've done an amazing job of telling stories without visual imagery today on this podcast. So, Charmaine, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Where can people find more of your work on the internet?
Oh, I mean, ILM.com will always have the most up-to-date projects that we're working on. I mean, I'm on Twitter at Charmaine SM Chan. And yeah, feel free to, you know, touch base with me anytime. I love chatting with people and, you know, talking about all the work that we've done and, you know, what there is out there to come. And it was an absolute pleasure talking to you both.
Well, thanks. Sorry. And where can people find the Women in VFX videos as well?
All right. So if you go to womeninvfx.com, you can find a whole slew of our videos. We're also on social media under the same handle, Women VFX. And yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Charmaine. Guys, that's where you can find her. If you're looking for the show, it's at Force Material on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the obvious places. We're at forcematerial.com. If you've got a message for us that cannot be constrained by the limits of social media, you can always hit us up at forcematerial@gmail.com. And if you've enjoyed this conversation today with Charmaine, look, feel free to head to your podcast platform of choice and throw us a 5-star review. We're not going to say no. I'm sure Charmaine's not going to say no. Nobody's going to say no.
Always 5 stars.
I'm Rowan Williams.
I'm Baz McAllister.
And I'm Charmaine Chan.
And you've just taken your first step into a larger world.